You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Traditional economics assumes rational actors. There's even a formula: optimization plus equilibrium equals economics. However, humans don't behave as Spock-like automatons, and that can lead to financial outcomes not predicted by the equation. Richard H. Thaler, a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, has been studying the relationship between behavioral sciences and economics for his entire career. He argues in his latest book, Misbehaving: The Making of Behavioral Economics, that it's time for economic models to account for recent discoveries in human psychology and to replace the fictional human who has no emotions with the real one. It's published by Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you much. Good to be here.
You open with a few anecdotes about some of the men that you have most respected in your career and suggest that it will hint at what's about to come in the book. The first is about Amos Tversky, whose papers and talks you describe as precise and perfect. Did you work with him?
Yes, I worked with him. We wrote a few papers together. I wrote more with Danny Kahneman, his collaborator, who I guess we'll get to in a minute.
That's the second one.
But he was a big inspiration to me.
What does the anecdote you relate here reveal about him to the reader, or reveal about what you're talking about?
Well, the anecdote is that Amos sadly died at age 59 in 1996, and at his funeral, his son Oren read a note that Amos had written to him in the last couple days, saying something about how Amos knew he was dying. He had pancreatic cancer, so he had lots of time to talk about it with his family, and he said that there's a long Jewish tradition that wisdom is passed on not through formulas and histories, but through stories and funny jokes. And that was my excuse for writing a book that's mostly stories.
The second anecdote involves Daniel Kahneman, who's been a guest on this show. And he described you in this way in an interview: the best thing about Thaler, what really makes him special, is that he's lazy. Did you take that as a compliment?
No. This was a very funny exchange. I happened to be in his living room, where I've spent many hours, and all of a sudden he remembers he's got a phone call coming from a reporter who's writing a story about me and wants to talk to my old friend and mentor, Danny. And then he said, "You want to leave?" No, I'll listen. It could be amusing. So he's having this interview, and then I hear Danny saying what you just read, and I'm waving at him and saying, "You know, really, I mean, okay, maybe I'm lazy, but is it my best quality?" And his explanation, he sticks to this story to this day. His explanation why it's a compliment is that he says that, "Because I'm lazy, I'm only willing to work on things that are important." And so I think I only put in the book stuff that I could overcome my natural laziness enough to write down.
You write about the effect the perception of numbers can have on students. For example, you say that as a young professor, you gave a midterm exam meant to group students into three categories: mastery, proficiency, and basic concepts, and of basic concepts, and those who didn't get it at all. And when you first made the test and scored it out of 100, what was the average?
So the average was 72, which was quite low. You know, these were graduate students at a Ivy League business school who were used to getting A's and A minuses. And so a 72 struck them as quite harsh.
And so they were very upset?
Oh, they were furious with me.
When you changed the total points to 137 on the exam, then What was the outcome?
Well, that exam turned out to be a little bit harder, 70% right, but the average score was 96. They loved me.
They didn't realize that they were actually getting less? These are future economists.
You know, I picked 137 with extreme care. In fact, I argue it is the optimal number of points for an exam because it's big enough that most people will get some score that looks quite good to them. A few even score above 100, which creates something like ecstasy. And yet 137 is hard to divide by, so most didn't bother.
So what happened with what did that 70% reveal, that they didn't get it at all?
No, it revealed that I wrote a really hard exam. And
they didn't like you for it.
And they didn't like being reminded of that.
Aren't most economic models based on fictional people who don't misbehave? This is what we were talking about at the beginning. You call them homo economicus.
Yeah, well, that's the Latin term, but I prefer to call them econs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, these econs are made up creatures. They're kind of like Spock on Star Trek.
Who made them up?
Economic theorists.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is economic theorists made them up because they of their own lack of analytical abilities. And what I mean by that is, I mean, most economists are better at math than me, but in the 1940s and 50s, economics went through a transformation, becoming much more mathematical. And if you try to write down mathematical models, the easiest ones to write down are of people being smart. And if you try to write down a model of people that are humans and are full of emotions and where the wording of a question can influence the answer that you get, then the math just gets a lot messier. And so so it was easier to write down models of these fictional creatures.
But you write that Adam Smith understood that economics has to consider the human factor, because before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote another book devoted to the topic of human passions. He is a god to most of the economists. How come they didn't notice this?
Well, you know, The Wealth of Nations is probably 500 pages. And, you know, the truth is few economists read anything more than 30 years old. And graduate students hardly read anything more than 20 years old. So I have a quiz. I ask my students at Chicago, and maybe this won't be a surprise, how many of them have ever read Keynes? And the answer is zero.
Really?
I joke that it's on the forbidden reading list at the University of Chicago. But
have they read Milton Friedman?
I think probably not. Right. So they just don't read anything old anymore. And so, yeah, economists were behavioral up until about 1940. Certainly Keynes was. Keynes was a great behavioral economist. And people now just think of Keynes as deficit spending. And it's become politicized. You know, Richard Posner, who's hardly a liberal, went back and read Keynes for the first time. I think he was probably in his late 60s and fell in love with it. And I suggest all readers go back and check it out of your library and read chapter 12. And you have to be impressed, no matter what your political persuasions.
My guest is Richard Thaler, who's co-author of the best-selling book Nudge with Cass Sunstein. He is a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. And for this year, he is the president of the American Economic Association. Congratulations.
Thank you. I don't know
if that's a good job or not.
You know, it's good to be elected. It's better to be past president.
We'll talk about that later. His book is Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. If the models don't account for misbehavior, then they must be bad at predicting outcomes.
Well, that's exactly right. So if we think about the financial crisis, there was misbehavior going on everywhere. And, you know, we all know about people taking out mortgages that they wouldn't be able to pay back if interest rates went ticked up after their teaser rate expired or real estate prices went down. And maybe that can be excused. They're unsophisticated. But what about the people who were selling them those mortgages? And more important, what about the people who were paying people $5,000 each for selling those mortgages, regardless of the ability to pay them back?
And what about the professionals who lost money?
You know, that's what I mean, there's misbehavior all the way up the line to the CEOs of big investment banks who didn't really understand what was in these fancy securities that they were selling.
You write, ironically, the existence of formal models based on the misconception of human behavior is what gives economics its reputation as the most powerful of the social sciences. Powerful in two distinct ways.
Yes, well, I mean, it's powerful in the way that, you know, we got models. They don't, you know. So
we use math.
We use math, and you guys can't even understand it. So, yeah, economists are pretty arrogant. They think they're the most physics-like of the social scientists, but it's physics without the engineering, you know? So it's like physics if you ignored things like atmosphere. It wouldn't be very good at building bridges.
And every once in a while you get a big bang, like the Depression in 1929 or the recession more recently.
Well, and you know, we've been having big bangs with greater frequency. So if you think in the last 20 years, we had the tech bubble and the real estate bubble and the financial crisis and there's more misbehaving going on than ever.
And yet economists have the most power in determining policy.
Yeah. Part of that, of course, is by default. So it's called the dismal science. I think in part it's because we economists make it dismal. But it's also that I think many people just find it boring. So if we could get psychologists and other social scientists involved in thinking about policy questions, which we're doing now, then they could help.
The core premise of economic theory is that people choose by optimizing. What does that mean?
It means that if you are deciding what route to take home tonight, you'll pick the best one. You'll choose as if you had Google Maps in your head.
Although Google Maps aren't always the best.
Well, you know, that's probably...
That's another issue.
Yeah, that's another
issue. But we have all these other things that affect our choices. If we pick a laundry detergent, for example, it's because our mother used that laundry detergent. That's why Tide has become so popular.
Yeah, and why they have 47 different versions of it taking up space in the aisle to fend off other brands. Yes, we're much more complicated than the creatures economists study,
well, could,
and more interesting.
Could that be written into an economic model, the power of brand identification, which can be irrational?
You know, the thing is, I think we want to not get hung up on the word rational, because it's kind of a loaded term. And people behave the way they behave. And the distinction is they're behaving differently than in economic models. And so the models are making bad predictions.
Every so often, the New York Times has a special edition, one of their many different things that they fold into the newspaper called Retirement. We're going to take a little break and talk about, we can't use the word rational when we're talking about retirement. But we can talk about related things like
yes.
Social Security.
Yeah, sure.
And saving and why people don't save well and whatever.
You can use whatever words you want.
Okay. My guest is Richard H. Thaler. His latest book, Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics, it is published by Norton. We'll be back with more right after this. And we're back with Richard Thaler, co-author of the best-selling book Nudge with Cass Sunstein, author also of Quasi-Rational Economics and The Winner's Curse. He's a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and for 2015 is the president of the American Economic Association. I mentioned retirement before you left. Since economists and their models influence public policy, making the assumption that people always optimize seems dangerous. One area in particular is about saving for retirement. Don't we have enough studies to prove that most people don't know how to properly save for retirement?
Yeah, I think we know that, and we should have known it all along. But in the gradual switch over from the old defined benefit kind of pension plans that were real pensions to 401ks, which are do-it-yourself savings plans, it took a while to figure out how badly those were working and how to fix them. And I think we now know basically how to fix them.
Well, there's been talk about privatizing Social Security, where people would be doing something similar to what they did with 401ks. Many people think that if we don't know how to do basic investing in the market anyway, this would be a disaster. Do you think it's a good idea?
No, I don't think it's a good idea. But the point I would want to stress is that probably the domain in which behavioral economics has had its biggest impact is in changing the way 401k plans look. So more than half of the large plans in the U.S. now include two features that I and my colleagues helped develop. One is automatic enrollment. So when you're first eligible, you get a big pile of papers, and it used to be you had to fill them out to join. Now you have to fill them out not to join. And now 90% of people join. And the second is automatic escalation, or what I like to call save more tomorrow, where you automatically increase the saving rates over time. Those things work.
But what about Social Security? People assume that when they retire, they're going to live off of the Social Security. It's not a lot of money. And even if you get the maximum, it's not a lot of money.
No, it's not a lot of money. That's why people better be using the 401k plan to their best advantage. Although even Social Security, people have... There's only one choice you have, which is when to start claiming. And my advice is wait as long as possible.
And then they force you to take the money.
Then they force you to take the money, but not until you're 70 and a half.
You've called one of your chapters, What Seems Fair? And one question that you posed in the study behind the chapter is, a hardware store has been selling snow shovels for $15. The morning after a large snowstorm, the store raises the price to $20. And then subjects were to rate the action as completely fair, acceptable, somewhat unfair, or very unfair. What were the results?
People hated that. And again, this is a study that's a surprise only if you're an economist. Getting training in economics kind of gives you a sort of common sense amnesia. So any normal person would say, well, that's a ripoff. Why would you do that?
But is this a supply and demand issue?
Exactly. So people do not think that a blizzard is a good excuse for raising prices. And
even if the store is running out of shovels?
Even that they think it's more fair to go with first come, first serve.
In the study, you found that temporary spikes in demand are an especially bad time for any business to appear greedy. And you write that one new business that's ignoring this advice, possibly to its peril, is Uber. They charge more during peak hours, although I'm not sure you always know what the peak hour is until you hand it the bill.
Yeah, that's right. It's not that I think variable pricing is necessarily a bad idea. Of course, airlines do it all the time. You pay more if you book at the last minute or at the holidays. I think Uber goes further with it than is smart. And they got into trouble for precisely the situation we described with our hardware store. So there was a blizzard in New York, and they raised the price by a factor of 10. People expect in society that when we have a big storm, we all chip in together. And that was kind of not in that spirit.
One of my producers told me that, I don't mean to pick on Uber, but I will, that she called Uber on a Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock to go from her home to Midtown Manhattan, which would have probably cost about $30, $35 in a cab. It cost her over $100 because they said it was a peak hour. Well, she was stunned.
Yeah. And
she'll never do that again. Well, so what would you suggest? What would you recommend that Uber do?
I would recommend that they cap the amount by which the price can surge. And in extreme situations, like in a blizzard, I would urge them to think of other ways of becoming helpers rather than offending people.
People often make financial plans for themselves, but they have a hard time controlling their impulses. How does behavioral economics control for a change in preferences or retail therapy that might throw a personal budget out of whack?
Well, the first thing behavioral economics does is recognize that we have self-control problems. You know, this, again, shouldn't be a big realization with quarter of the country obese and many people unable to save for retirement. And then once you recognize that, you say, well, what do I do when I have a self-control problem? You know, this morning I had to get up very early to be on some television show, so I set two alarm clocks, right? So it's just recognizing your own human weaknesses and then taking – it's like having piggy banks.
In the 40 years that you've been in the field, have you seen more acceptance of behavioral economics?
Absolutely. But it's not that I've changed anybody's mind. No, to a first approximation in academia, no one ever changes their mind. There's a famous line from Max Planck that science marches on funeral by funeral. And so there's lots of young economists that have taken up the call and they're doing all the work.
Getting back to controlling ourselves, why are some people better at saving than others? Is this something that we get from our parents?
Yeah, sure. There are. Yes, and yes. So, partly comes from your parents, but anybody who's had more than one kid knows that the kids come out differently, and so. Some have all their homework done before dinner, and some you're still yelling at late into the night.
And then one kid lives a very Spartan life, and the next one is a hoarder.
Right. So it's not all parents. Some of it is inborn. But the ones who have trouble with it are the ones for whom we need to help them, give them good strategies.
You write that, much to everyone's surprise, the behavioral approach to economics has had its greatest impact in finance. What impact has it had on finance?
Well, in academic finance, there has been a debate that I helped start in a paper I wrote in 1985 about what's called the efficient market hypothesis. And
does anybody go along with that anymore?
Some of my colleagues, some one of my most frequent golf buddies is a strong adherent of the efficient market hypothesis. The argument has two components. One is you can't beat the market, and the second is that prices are right. There are no bubbles. The first part is arguably, at least approximately, true. The second, I think we've seen enough of these bubbles now to realize it can be wildly off.
What happened, some people thought financial markets are a place where foolish behavior doesn't move market prices one iota.
Well,
has that proven to be true?
Let me tell you a recent story that illustrates the falsity of that. There's a mutual fund called that has the ticker symbol CUBA. It, of course, has nothing to do with Cuba. It's a Caribbean fund, but that's the ticker symbol. The day that President Obama made his announcement, this fund went from selling at a 15% premium to a 70% from a 15% discount to a 70%.
So people don't do research.
You know, Cuba looks good. President's friendly. Prices pop. And I could give you many of those stories.
And this is all about people believing that they can beat the market. They saw Cuba. They immediately thought, I'm going to get in before.
Yeah, before everybody else, right.
Of course, there were many people who believed Bernie Madoff could beat the market and get great results. In fact, too many really smart people thought that. A few realized that what he was promising was impossible.
Right, but too few, and especially the regulators. And, you know, I come across sometimes as picking on my profession, and I don't think that should be overblown. Economists really are the only ones who understand how these things work. And one thing wrong with the SEC, I once had a conversation with the director of the SEC, and I asked her, what was the ratio of lawyers to economists at the SEC? And, it, you know, it's more than 100-1. So they went in and inspected Bernie Madoff's operation two or three times and didn't see anything wrong.
Now, aren't computers supposed to get past the whole irrationality of humans?
Well, you know, computers are only as good as the programmer. So
were they fooled by Cuba?
I doubt it. That sounds like a pretty human error to me, and the kind of people who buy that fund, I'm pretty sure that was a human error. But, you know, this flash crash we had was certainly computer generated.
John Maynard Keynes thought that emotions, or what he called animal spirits, played an important role in individual decision making, including investment decisions. In fact, didn't he believe that professional money managers were actually just playing an intricate guessing game and might be more susceptible to irrational exuberance at times?
Yeah, he has this wonderful passage where he talks about professional investment. He likens it to what would now be considered a politically incorrect contest, where they would put up a poster of 100 attractive young women, and the goal was to guess which six would be judged the prettiest. And as he writes, the object is not to say which six you think are the prettiest, or even which six others think are the prettiest, but which six others will think, others will think, others will think. And that's the same with investing. If finding a stock that's too cheap isn't any good if it's not going to get less cheap.
Why are hedge fund managers compensated as if they have beaten the market when they often don't?
Well, it's true that many hedge funds get paid as if the basis on which they are compared is the interest rate you'd get on a treasury bond, which is zero right now. So that's a pretty low hurdle to jump over.
In the future, you are most anxious to see the field of macroeconomics adopt the behavioral realistic approach. Why?
I think, you know, the last 7 years has shown that we were massively overconfident in the extent to which we think we could control the economy. And economists are not really in agreement about whether we should have more or less austerity. I mean, this is pretty basic. And
the big fight in Europe right now, and to some degree in this country.
Right.
When it comes to bridges and infrastructure, suddenly we talk austerity.
Yeah. And
or Amtrak.
And I think the last 7 years, when we've had zero interest rates and large amounts of unemployment, to not be borrowing at a zero interest rate and building roads and bridges and infrastructure is unbelievably stupid.
Paul Krugman has never deviated from his view that we should have spent more than we did. You agree?
I agree. And
but that makes you a Keynesian, doesn't it?
Not necessarily. I mean, if you're a Keynesian, then you think that it's going to stimulate the economy. And I would say these investments make sense even if you don't believe in that.
But they do also create jobs.
They will create jobs. And so if there's a Keynesian multiplier, all the better. But meanwhile, half the bridges in this country need to be repaired. Why not do it now when money is cheap and people are unemployed?
Conservatives worry that such investments won't be well spent and that the national debt will create a budgetary crisis and then we'll wind up with out-of-control inflation.
Well, you know, those people were also forecasting that the quantitative easing of the Fed would lead to massive inflation, and for the last 7 years they've been wrong. I mean, it's certainly the case that if you tried to spend a lot of money very fast, some of it would have been wasted. And I think one of the mistakes we made, and it's because Congress is so inept right now, that the initial stimulus, there was a big emphasis on so-called shovel ready. And I think if we had any sense as how long this was going to last, the sensible policy would have been a very deliberate one of picking projects with high rates of return and that will like making the railroads. The fact that we have such a horrible railroad system between Washington and Boston is just an embarrassment if you've ever been to any other country in the world.
Well, there are people in this country who see investing money in the kind of fast trains that we will find in European countries and Japan as just a waste of money. After all, we have other methods of transport that have done rather well for us.
I think in many contexts that's correct. So I'm not sold on the high-speed train in California necessarily.
Even the Elon Musk one in the tube?
You know, if Elon Musk builds it, I will buy it. But you know, when the problem is, and actually Uber may solve this problem. The problem with taking a train to L.A. is that what do you do when you get there? But, you know, in the Northeast Corridor where there's such dense population, it's a no-brainer that to have a good train system.
You write that one important macroeconomic policy begging for a behavioral analysis is how to fashion a tax cut aimed at stimulating the economy. How would you approach that, and how effective has trickle-down economics proven to be? Because it's still being proposed in many places. Kansas, for example, where Sam Brownback
right.
is in trouble because of what he suggested, but that doesn't mean that it isn't continually being proposed.
So I think that we have to distinguish between two different kinds of tax cuts. So what I was referring to there in that passage was the temporary tax cut at the beginning of the crisis, which was meant mostly to put money in the hands of the middle class and you wanted them to spend it.
Did that work?
Yes, that worked. There's a poll of economists that the University of Chicago conducts, and virtually unanimous agreement that that worked. There's no incentive. There's no data to suggest that tax cuts to the rich do much of anything.
Richard H. Thaler, His latest book is Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.